We are in Ezekiel chapter number 45, and we're going to start in verse number 7 in just a moment. First, let me remind you that this is all part of Ezekiel's final vision. It's chapters 40 through 48, all happened in 574 BC. That's 14 years after the city was destroyed and after the temple was destroyed. And so Ezekiel's being shown what could happen if the Israelis will just come back to the land in repentance and holiness and trust of God, how they can build a new and beautiful temple that God will come and dwell in with great power and presence, and how they'll be able to build a new city, and how they can have a new country with new inheritance rights if they'll just trust God. Now, the problem, of course, is they didn't. So none of this was able to occur in the return from Babylon under Zerubbabel and Joshua and Ezra and Nehemiah. Smaller things happened. God's holy presence didn't come in power into the Zerubbabel temple. And so it's all kind of a sad situation that it was not realized like it could have been. The story of Jesus would have been completely different if this pattern had been taken up by the Israeli people. But that's not what happened, so we can't go there. But I want you to hear all of the descriptions here, because at least some of the things do happen in the millennial time period. Now, I don't believe that the millennial temple is going to be built for sacrifice of animals. I've shared with you my conviction that Jesus Christ died once for all, and there were no animal sacrifices necessary after that, and that they won't happen during the millennial period. That's my conviction. But there's still other things in this section, such as the division of the land, which might, in fact, be tied into the millennial time period. So in the first part of chapter 45, Ezekiel describes the holy zone that surrounds the temple complex. And this is basically a 25,000 cubit by 25,000 cubit square. When you take all the measurements that are described here into consideration, it forms a square around the temple. And that's basically 8.17 miles squared, 8.7 miles on each of the four sides. So that's the holy zone where the temple is located, where the worship takes place, where the priests live and work, where the Levites live and work, and where the city of Jerusalem, the worship city of Jerusalem, is located. Now, I've already described how later we're going to see the tribal regions will be bands of territory, starting in the north and going all the way to the south border. And this holy zone of 8 by 8 miles, basically, is going to be part of a strip that goes from the Mediterranean to the eastern border, which is basically the Jordan Valley, Dead Sea Valley. And on each sides of it, this holy square will be territory not devoted to any particular tribe, but to the prince of the people that we've already talked about once. This prince, he's not a king, that's not the word that's used. This prince, this raised up one, is going to be the leader in the return period. Some people who want to make this all about the millennial, they'll say, well, this has to be Jesus. Well, there's a problem with that, because this prince will later be talked about as having kids and grandkids, and it will also be talked about what should happen if he sins. So that cannot possibly be a description of Jesus in the millennial period. It's another one of my reasons why I don't think that that's what this section is about. But this prince, he needs to have his own zone in order to keep from intruding on the people who are living in the other tribal regions. Because what happened in the past, something that God told Samuel to warn the people about, is that a king will often cannibalize the other people of the nation in order to take care of his own desires. He will force them to tithe to him. He will force them to give up their properties to him in order for him to be in charge. And so that was part of the curse of leadership. Well, the way that God takes care of it in this time period is he gives this prince control of this band that's apparently a little over 8 miles north and south, but 30-some miles east and west on both sides of the holy zone. And that's his territory specifically to do with as he wishes. So here's what it says, verse 7 of chapter 45. To the prince shall belong the land on both sides of the holy district and the property of the city, alongside the holy district and the property of the city, on the west and on the east, corresponding in length to one of the tribal portions and extending from the western to the eastern boundary of the land. It is to be his property in Israel. And my princes, plural, because it's expected he is going to have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, shall no more oppress my people, but they shall let the house of Israel have the land according to their tribes. So this will be the leader's inheritance zone, so that he will not try to confiscate properties out of any of the other tribal zones. Verse number 9. Thus says he who is God, enough, O princes of Israel, put away violence and oppression, and execute justice and righteousness. Cease your evictions of my people, declares he who is God. This was evidently a big problem in the latter stages of Judah, where the kings were confiscating properties all over the place for their own purposes. And they were also cheating people by measurements. And so in the return that we're looking at here from exile, they were not supposed to go back to those procedures. They were supposed to be holy as God is holy and to live righteous lifestyles, including the leader. So God puts all that in writing through Ezekiel. Verse 10, you shall have just balances. So straight up fair lengths and measures and weights, all of that's got to be standardized. A just ephah and a just bath. An ephah is a measurement of a dry container, and a bath is a measurement using a wet container. The ephah and the bath shall be of the same measure, the bath containing 1/10 of an homer, and the ephah 1/10 of an homer, and the homer shall be a standard measure. Excuse me. So basically, God is saying you're going to have these very specific measurements that you're supposed to use, and it won't matter whether it's wet or dry. It's going to be the same volume that we're talking about here. And it's, I think an ephah ends up being something like 22 liters. So think of 11 2-liter pop bottles full of dry or wet, doesn't matter. An ephah would be the dry and a bath would be the wet. So the homer, whether dry or wet, is basically 220 liters of dry or liquid. the shekel, which at this time was not a coin, but a weight of metal, shall be 20 gerahs. So a shekel ends up being about 2/5 of an ounce, or 11 grams of metal. 20 shekels plus 25 shekels plus 15 shekels shall be your mina. So you add all those up, and that's how much a mina will be. Verse 13, this is the offering that you shall make. Okay, now we're going to talk about how to use those measures in making offerings out of your increase. 1/6 of an ephah for each homer of wheat. So 1/6 of 22 liters for every 220 liters of wheat needs to be given to God. Same thing for each homer of barley. And as the fixed portion of oil measured in baths, 1/10 of a bath for each core, and that's just the liquid name for a homer. The core, like the homer, contained 10 baths. And 1 sheep from every flock of 200. So 1 sheep out of 200 goes to God. From the watering places of Israel for grain offering, burnt offerings, and peace offerings to make atonement for them, declares he who is God. All the people of the land shall be obliged to give this offering to the prince of Israel. So that's effectively the tax that's going to be given to the leader by the people, apparently each year. So it's less than a tithe in most cases. Wouldn't it be nice if we only had to pay a tax of less than 10% for our leadership? Back to the text. Verse 17, it shall be the prince's duty to furnish the burnt offerings, grain offerings, and drink offerings at the feasts, that'd be Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, the new moons, that's the first day of every month, the new moon was signaled by the first visible crescent at sunset of a new moon cycle, and so every new moon was considered a holiday, and the Sabbaths, that's every seventh day. So for all of the days off, all of the holidays, the prince of the land was to provide the sacrifices on behalf of all the people on those days. The rest of the year, the people were supposed to be providing those sacrifices. He shall provide the sin offering, grain offerings, burnt offerings, and peace offerings to make atonement on behalf of the house of Israel. So his leadership role is when the people are supposed to be enjoying days off for holidays, he's picking up the slack. Verse 18, thus says he who is God, in the first month, on the first day of the month, so this is the new year, by the Exodus calendar, that is the calendar that was put into place at the Exodus. So it's the springtime calendar of Israel. So on the first day of that first month, you shall take a bull from the herd without blemish and purify the sanctuary. So every year at the beginning of the spring of the new cycle of the year, they were supposed to have a special cleansing sacrifice to start off another year of sacrifices. The priest shall take some of the blood of the sin offering and put it on the doorposts of the temple, the four corners of the ledge of the altar, and the posts of the gate of the inner court. This is all part of a New Year's sacrifice ceremony. You shall do the same on the seventh day of the month for anyone who has sinned through error or ignorance, so that you can make atonement for the temple. So, first day of the month is for the majority of the people. But there's almost always a few people that are unclean on that particular day, so they couldn't participate. So 7 days later, a makeup session will be authorized. Then, verse 21, In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, you shall celebrate the feast of Passover. So this is the anniversary of the Exodus itself, when God's wrath passed over all of the houses that were marked with the blood of the Passover lamb. So every year, in this return, they're supposed to celebrate the Passover. And then for 7 days, unleavened bread shall be eaten. So the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st days of that first month, that's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's probably representing the time that it took Israel to leave and make it across the sea on the day that God drowned the Egyptian army. Because at that point, they were able to slow down and start having leavened bread thereafter. So it probably represents the first week of their travels in the wilderness. It's a mandatory festival. On that day, verse 22, the prince shall provide for himself and all the people of the land a young bull for a sin offering. And on the 7 days of the festival, he shall provide as a burnt offering to he who is 7 young bulls, 7 rams without blemish on each of the 7 days, and a male goat for a sin offering. And he shall provide as a grain offering an ephah for each bull, an ephah for each ram, and a hin of oil for each ephah. So he's supposed to be providing the special sacrifices on these special holidays. So this is an example for Ezekiel to pass on as to how it would work with Passover time and Feast of Unleavened Bread. Then an example from the seventh month. In the seventh month, on the 15th day of the month, and for the 7 days of the feast, he shall make the same provision for sin offerings, burnt offerings, and grain offerings, and for the oil. That's the Feast of Tabernacles. So he has to provide all these special things on those days as well. Now, let's keep talking about this prince, this raised up leader. What's his responsibilities for the year? Chapter 46, thus says he who is God, the gate of the inner court that faces east shall be shut on the 6 working days, but on the Sabbath day it shall be opened, and on the day of the new moon it shall be opened. So this is the inner gate court. This is the one that goes into the worship court. Now, the gate that is on the outer court, the eastern gate, that's sealed. Remember that the prince goes in there and can eat his meals in that place as part of his special responsibilities as leader. But this is the worship court gate. It is closed during the work days, Sunday through Friday. Now, it gets opened on the first day of the month, and it gets opened on all Sabbath days so that people can go, so that people can see it opened and activities happening around it, because those are special days. Those are actually non-work days, by the way. Verse 2, the prince shall enter by the vestibule of the gate from the outside and shall take his stand by the post of the gate. The priest shall offer his burnt offering and his peace offerings, and he shall worship at the threshold of the gate. Then he shall go out, but the gate shall not be shut until evening. So he comes through this gate on these special days in order to participate in public worship. He sets the example for everybody else coming through this special gate on these special days. And then when he's done, he goes back out, but the gate doesn't get closed up until the day is over. That is, until the sun goes down. Verse 3, the people of the land shall bow down at the entrance of that gate before he who is on the Sabbaths and on the new moons. The burnt offerings that the prince offers to he who is on the Sabbath day shall be 6 lambs without blemish and a ram without blemish. The grain offering from the ram shall be an ephah. The grain offerings with the lamb shall be as much as he is able, together with a hin of oil to each ephah. On the day of the new moon, he shall offer a bull from the herd without blemish, six lambs and a ram, which shall be without blemish. As a grain offering, he shall provide an ephah with the bull and an ephah with the ram and with the lambs as much as he's able, together with a hin of oil to each ephah. This is actually the setup for a meal, because only representative portions of these sacrifices will be burned up on the altar. The rest of it will be cooked and eaten in worship dinners. And so the prince here is actually paying for some worship meals on these special days. Verse 8, when the prince enters, he shall enter by the vestibule of the gate, and he shall go out by the same way. Let me remind you again, I do not think that this has anything to do with the millennial temple, the millennial period, because sacrifices are not part of that, I don't believe. And one of the other things that we know about the millennium is it is a time of vegetarianism returning to the norm, where animals are not eaten any longer. So I do not see the burning up of these animals for meals as being part of the procedure of the millennium. So that's another one of my reasons for not thinking that this was intended for any other time period than that which was immediately after the return from Babylon until the coming of the Messiah. And since they never built it, it didn't happen this way. Verse number 11. At the feasts and the appointed festivals, the grain offering with a young bull shall be an ephah, with a ram an ephah, with the lambs as much as one is able to give, together with hin of oil to an ephah. And when the prince provides a freewill offering, either a burnt offering or peace offering as a freewill offering to he who is, the gate facing east shall be open for him. Meaning, he can declare a special, I just want to give a special offering to God day. And the gate gets opened and people get to eat of that special worship meal. He shall offer his burnt offerings or his peace offerings as he does on the Sabbath day. Then he shall go out, and after he has gone out, the gate shall be shut. So very, very special relationship between the prince and the people. He's supposed to be a great example of what worshiping God is all about. Verse 13, you shall provide a lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering to he who is daily, morning by morning you shall provide it. You shall provide a grain offering with its morning by morning, 1/6 of an ephah, 1/3 of a hin of oil to moisten the flour as a grain offering to he who is. This is a perpetual statute. This, thus the lamb and the meal offering, the oil shall be provided morning by morning for a regular burnt offering. This just goes into detail about the twice daily offerings on behalf of all the people to bring them back into right relationship as the day begins. Mid-morning is actually when this offering was given. And then as the day is starting to decline, mid-afternoon. It was a maintenance relationship offering to remind the people day by day, morning and afternoon, that they belong to God and they need to live appropriately. Thus says he who is God, if the prince makes a gift to any of his sons as his inheritance, so this is one of the places where we find out the prince has kids. So again, doesn't seem to be anything about Jesus here. It shall belong to his sons, because it's his property given to a member of his family. It is their property by inheritance. But if he makes a gift out of his inheritance to one of his servants, it shall be his to the year of liberty, and then it shall revert to the prince. Surely as is an inheritance, it shall be belong to his sons. The prince shall, before we go on, so basically he can also give gifts to the people that work for him, but because they are from the other tribes, it's not their permanent property. It will revert in the 50th year to the prince's descendants, because that's just the way it worked. The prince shall not take any of the inheritance of the people, thrusting them out of their property. So he's not supposed to be confiscating properties anywhere else in the land. He has his own strip, and he's supposed to leave everybody else's stuff alone. He shall give his sons their inheritance out of his own property, so that none of my people shall be scattered from his property. So this is the protection of the property rights of the people in the promised land. It's just a redoing at the return what was supposed to have been done in Joshua's day as well. And so this time, they don't get around to doing it because they don't occupy the entire promised land, unfortunately. Verse 19, then he brought me through the entrance, which was at the side of the gate, to the north row of the holy chambers for the priests. Behold, a place was there at the extreme western end of them. And he said, this is the place where the priests shall boil the guilt offering and the sin offering, and where they shall bake the grain offering, in order not to bring them out into the outer court and so communicate holiness to the people. So the holy gifts to God are supposed to be kept in the holy area. So even the cooking of them has to take place here. Then he brought me out to the outer court and led me around to the four corners of the court. And behold, in each corner of the court, there was another court. And in the four corners of the court were small courts, 40 cubits long. 40 cubits basically is 69 feet by the long cubit. The four were of the same size. On the inside, each of the four corners was a row of masonry with hearths made at the bottom of the rows all around. And then he said to me, these are the kitchens where those who minister in the temple shall boil the sacrifices of the people. So outside of the priestly area, there's another kitchen area, a massive kitchen area, where the sacrifices can be cooked up for the people to enjoy in their worship fellowship meals. And so there's this division between the priestly area and then the place where the common people worship. And it's just part of this complex design. Come back tomorrow and we will hit what I consider the most exciting part of the whole vision.